Hello and welcome back to Your Politics Show here on Mix 92.6 FM. This is Your Politics Show because we talk about national and local issues, but the main thrust of the conversation is directed by your questions that you send in all through the month, and we put them to the local politicians. This week we're speaking to local MP Bim Afolami, the Conservative MP for Hitchin and Harpenden. Welcome back to the show, Bim. It's our first interview of 2023, and we must address the crisis in the NHS. There's been 2,004 excess deaths above the five-year average in the week to January 6th across the UK. There are record waiting lists, record lengths of times waiting for ambulances, and horror stories of the conditions for nurses, doctors, and patients. This is a situation that requires short-term and long-term changes. What needs to be done and what is going to be done?
It's not easy, but fundamentally what we need to do is we need conditions to be better, pay to be improved, and the system to ease up. Because once the system eases up, not only do people get treated better, but also the workforce is happier and the morale's improved. So that is like in a real fundamental way what we need to do.
And how is that going to be achieved? You know, you talked there about easing things up, but this goes back to what I've just said there, record waiting times for ambulances, lists, you know, and when I chatted to Daisy Cooper about this, she said the main issue seems to be getting people into social care. So how are those numbers going to be increased?
I mean, there isn't really a quick fix. I mean, look, I could just say, oh, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. The problem in social care is not per se the beds. It's people to man the beds, if that makes sense. And there's a huge recruitment problem we have in social care. But guess what? That's the same problem we have in all sorts of other areas, private sector and public sector. There's just a workforce. You know, COVID, after COVID, we had 500,000 people leave the workforce. And a huge amount of effort in government is going on right now to try and get those people back into the workforce because they've all left critical jobs and they've often been experienced people who also were key to training and developing younger workers as well. And that is, I think, the most acute problem right now is just lack of experienced people in jobs.
You know, we've asked this question before, but what do you say to criticism that the situation in the NHS is a problem created by underfunding the NHS for over a decade? We look at the kind of average increases in spending, and the average was 4% from 1955-56 to 2019-20. But looking at the years of the Conservative government from 2009-10 onwards, it's actually less than that 4%, and it only goes above that in the 2019-20 period, and there's actually years of reduction as well. So why should people trust the Conservatives to be able to get out of this problem when a lot of these have arisen under your rule?
Because the reason why we've got an acute problem now is not to do with underfunding. Funding on any measure, whether you do per head, the total, compared to other countries, has gone up way above sort of inflation over the last 10, 12 years. The difficulties are systemic, but they're mostly to do with an aging population and COVID. And if we're very honest, in my view, when we did the reforms, people, only a few listeners will really remember these, but there was Andrew Lansley did some reforms in 2012, 2013. Those did not deliver what we needed them to deliver. We focus much more on efficiency than resilience. And I think that COVID has exposed the weakness in that choice. But now, as a society, as a country, as a government, we recognise that and are going to make the necessary changes.
Just to bring it back to a point that you said there, Bim, though, you said that this has been created or partially, I don't want to take the words out of your mouth, by the COVID situation. But if we look at the waiting times, if we look at a lot of the numbers, they were already decreasing before COVID hit the country. So again, maybe as you said there, it could be due to other issues. You believe that the funding has been fine. So again, why can people trust this time around? You know, we've been told from 2010 to now that the Conservatives are the people to get this job done. But you've had, you know, 13 years of possibilities and there has been no improvement as of yet.
Well, you say 13 years, but the fact is the challenge is now different, right? So the question is, can we as a party in the government adapt to the challenges now? I think we are, but people will judge that at the election. It's wrong to say, you've been in power for ages, these things happen, you know, because of you. Well, there are external reasons why certain things are the way they are. The question is, how do we deal with those? And that's what we're going to do.
And one of the ways that people are talking about is this new era of austerity. But just to put it to you, Bim, political analysts are stating that Labour only find themselves ahead in the polls due to being seen as the lesser of two evils in the electorate. And actually, the electorate can't see much difference in the ideas of Starmer and Sunak. You might want to contest that. But many economists have taken to task the ideas that spending must be balanced like a household. Keynesian economists like Paul Krugman have explained that instead of trying to reduce public deficits in a recession, the government should increase spending, helping businesses to grow and providing employment. Government debt will rise, of course, but the government can run fiscal surpluses to pay it down when the growth returns. Austerity, Paul Krugman describes, is for the good times, not the bad times. And adding to this, you know, during the election period of Rishi Sunak becoming party leader, he himself and lots of economists in general have criticised the growth, lack of investment for a decade under Conservative rule. Why is it then that the Conservative Party are committing to old ideas of austerity rather than maybe trying something new?
But I mean, we are doing something new. Some of it has been good, some of it hasn't worked out so well. I think that in the aftermath of COVID, I think what we did was we spent a huge amount of money, over £400 billion. To give you context, the British government spends about £1 trillion in a year. And we spent almost half that on COVID. What that the result of that has been, you know, significant impact on the public finances. I just don't think anyone can say this is austerity. But when you have that level of impact on public finances, you have to try and start getting the budget back to some form of balance. We're right to spend when there's an emergency like COVID, but that doesn't mean you continue to spend in that way. I don't think anybody thinks that's sensible. And I know Paul Krugman, you know, says, oh, it's not like a household. That's also true. But should I tell you what also matters? As Liz Truss showed, when you spend without recourse to the broader market of people who you need to buy your debt, if they do not have faith in you, the cost of doing that goes through the roof, as we have literally seen a few months back with Liz Truss. So the country sees what happens when you don't manage your debt position carefully. And Rishi isn't going to make that mistake.
We shall move it on then to, instead of country's finances, we're going to talk about Nadeem Zahawi's finances. The former chancellor was fired when an inquiry by Sunak's ethic advisor concluded Zahawi failed to declare being investigated for tax avoidance. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has defended Zahawi's situation, saying he acted pretty decisively and fairly as well. But what is your belief on this issue?
I think that the Prime Minister did what any fair-minded person in the situation would do, which is he asked for an explanation. Nadeem said, look, you know, I deserve to stay in post. The Prime Minister said, OK, present all the facts. He sent them to the independent ministerial advisor for guidance, and that advisor concluded pretty comprehensively that he thought Nadeem Zahawi had broken the ministerial code. That's the point of having an advisor. So I sort of think, and then when he knew that, he dealt with it very quickly. I mean, but for people that said, oh, he should have just fired him, these are the same people that said, oh, no, the Prime Minister needs an ethics advisor. If you've got an ethics advisor, it's important that you show and go through due process if you fire someone. So I think broadly the Prime Minister managed it as well as he could have done. Though, of course, I wouldn't have wanted to have been in this position. And, you know, it's not ideal for the party or the government.
The report, as you stated there, on Nadeem Zahawi's behaviour identified several breaches in the ministerial code. But a lot of people have revisited the appointment of Suella Braverman after her own breaching of the ministerial code. There's been demands by Labour and Liberal Democrats to have a similar investigation as you've described there into Nadeem Zahawi. And even one of your own colleagues, Caroline Noakes, has called for an inquiry for her return to the Cabinet office after these alleged breaches of the ministerial code. So why was one breach allowed, but another worthy of sacking?
I think that Suella was fired for it. And the Prime Minister said, well, you know, you deserve a second chance. You made a mistake. It happened right at the beginning of your tenure. And he gave her another chance. I don't think, you know, every situation is different, but I don't think that in principle, you should say if somebody has left a government position that they have to be out forever. I don't think that's a sensible way of proceeding.
So is Nadeem Zahawi not out forever as well? Is he likely to make a return?
No, I don't think so. Well, obviously, I don't know if he's going to come back, right? But what I do know is I don't think you should have a situation where because somebody's forced to leave government, they are never allowed to enter government again. I think that would be quite an odd thing to say.
Would it be fair to question the timing, though? Because obviously, Suella Braverman, 10 days later, she was back in government. Do you not think that that was a little bit too soon?
It was a very, very weird time, as everybody will remember. And things happened incredibly quickly. So everything was happening quickly. It's probably, you know, quite quick that you change prime minister within 44 days. You know, that isn't normal either. But the principle, as I set out, is really the same.
And just one last question on this. Do you think that this sends a wrong message that, you know, Zahawi's was a tax affair, Braverman's was an issue of national security? Does this say to people that you're prioritizing tax over security or prioritizing political expedience over security? I mean, what does the whole affair say to you? Or is it, as you're describing there, it's a situational thing?
Well, the impact of it politically is obviously not good, but it is a situation. And you've just got to hope that we get past it and govern properly in the interest of the country and people notice that.
Let's turn it to yourself this week. Earlier this week, you said you welcomed the departmental restructuring that binds net zero as an equal partner in the quest for energy security. Going forward, Bim, what does this look like?
It looks like, as it says on the tin, in essence, we are now, we've got a government department that's entirely focused on this thing. I think it will make a difference in a positive way. Proof of the pudding's in the eating, but the BEIS department, Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy, was huge and is quite difficult to coordinate. And I think that having smaller focus departments may make a difference.
Just maybe in terms of, I don't know if you want to reveal too much or if anything is happening in the pipeline, but you look at Labour, they've kind of announced their new green energy company, that they're talking about a new green situation. You know, there's a lot of bywords, there's a lot of positivity, but what does this look in terms of maybe policy from the Conservative Party? You know, like you said there, net zero equal with energy security. Maybe in a few examples, what are going to be the improvements over the next, you know, 10 years towards that goal?
I mean, look, there are a lot of things that we're obviously doing around electric vehicles, around insulating homes, all of these things that, look, a lot of people are aware of. I'll talk about something quickly that people aren't aware of, and I'm doing some work on this at the moment and hopefully be able to announce more in the coming, you know, weeks, is on hydrogen and the importance of using hydrogen to decarbonize sort of heavy goods vehicles, heavy industry. And if we do that right, we can be world leaders in it. And if we can be world leaders in it, it could have a significant economic benefit to the country at the same time as decarbonizing. It will transform the environment in the city and town centers that are currently choked full of fumes because of heavy goods vehicles, right? It will give huge opportunities for jobs and scientific technological sphere. And it will help reindustrialize parts of the country. I think it's really exciting. It's a new technology. We need to get on with it. But, you know, I know the Prime Minister is committed to it because I've spoken to him about it. So, you know, hopefully in the coming weeks, I'll have some more information for you on that.
Does this link to one of the visits that you did to a local company as well? Carnot.
It does.
So do you want to describe about them? You know, they're working to decarbonize transport in areas where electric vehicles won't work. What did you find out there?
This particular company has developed a really innovative technology which will use hydrogen. And though I must be honest and say I'm not a scientist, and so my knowledge on how this works is a bit limited, why they called me was, first of all, so I could see it and champion what they do, but secondly, to make sure that we make the technical regulatory changes required so that we can incentivize businesses to use technologies like theirs. And that's quite detailed techie work, but it's really, really important. So that's something that I'm already working on.
Let's switch it to a local issue. And one of the ones that you've been working on is to open Eastern access to Hitchin train station. You said it's one of your top priorities, but is this any closer to happening?
Well, I'm basically going to apply for the next round of the levelling up funding. The council, North Isles Council, didn't apply for it last time, despite saying that they were going to, because it all got, you know, they had manpower problem, capacity problem. They didn't end up doing it. Deeply frustrating for me, but they assure me that now we can work forward to the next round. And then hopefully, by the end of this parliament, later on this year, we'll have this money allocated and the work can begin.
Now, discussing with the council, earlier this month, you wrote to the leader of the St. Albans City and District Council, raising your concerns about the plans to axe free parking for Harpenden Leisure Centre users, and this affects St. Albans as well. What's been discussed, and will this go ahead?
Well, the truth is, it's up to the council. I've protested on people's behalf, but it's not my decision. I have to be honest about that. The council can ignore me and ignore local people as much as they want. So, you have to ask them whether they're going to go through with it.
So you don't? They've not contacted you any further.
They haven't
on this
told
issue.
Me. No, they have not.
We shall see how the situation develops over the coming weeks. Then, now before we get to the community questions, we move on to a very tough local topic for some listeners, and this may be upsetting. You can tune out for a few minutes as we talk about the case of David Carrick, if this is triggering for you. He has now pleaded guilty to a total of 49 offences, including rape, sexual assault, coercive control, and false imprisonment. St. Albans MP Daisy Cooper said the case shows that the government needs to reform policing. Bim, do you agree with these sentiments, and what can you tell us on the progress over this matter? Because quite often now, the discussion point is about women not feeling safe with police.
Unless the Met Police, but police forces generally, particularly the Met, realise that protecting your own is not normally a virtue when the offences are really very serious, we will continue to have these things happen. It's really as simple as that. It is not because there are lots of these people necessarily in the police. It's that the bad apples are not thrown out. They're protected. I think that that's the problem.
Is it a systemic problem then? I mean, how can this be sorted?
No, I don't know. The commissioner of the Met will do what he can. By all accounts, he's very able and doing a good job. But I'm afraid it's bigger than one person at the very top. It's about widespread cultural change in the police that mirrors the sort of changes we saw in the aftermath of Stephen Lawrence, her murder, which is probably now 20-odd years ago, if not more. And what that did around the Met's treatment of black people and ethnic minorities, which over a generation genuinely has improved and changed, and the Met is a much better police force in that regard, no doubt. But I think we need a similar sort of cultural change on this subject.
And where does that come from? Does it come from the Met? Does it come from the government as well? Who's going to spearhead this?
Look, the government's always in a key position, but I'm afraid the Met needs to take responsibility.
So just a reminder for those of you who may have experienced similar issues in the St. Albans area, there's a lot of information out there. There is help in the St. Albans area in the NHS website as well. We'll put that up on the Mix 92.6 website when this goes live. But let's move it to the community questions. And Catherine sounds very angry. She sent in a quite strongly worded question for you, Bim. She said, how is there any sort of justification for tax breaks for private schools? She has said, it's beyond idiotic. These people are already privileged enough and depriving state schools of money. What are your thoughts, Bim?
Well, first of all, they're not depriving anybody of anything. Tax breaks, they're not tax breaks. You are charity. If you are a charity, it's because you provide certain services, of which education is one of them. If you choose to make that more expensive for private schools, which Labour think is an intelligent idea, which I doubt, then all that happens is you drive people out of those schools into the state sector. Now, that may or may not be a good or bad thing. Nothing inherently wrong with that. But if you do that, the consequence on the state sector means you get more crowded class sizes, more difficulty for the kids already in the state sector, because don't forget, the kids that are in private sector are already paying their taxes, right? They're paying their taxes already. So it means net, the state sector ends up in under more pressure, more strain. I don't think that's a sensible way to proceed. And it's motivated basically by envy and class politics than by anything else, because the amount of money it would raise is so small, it doesn't nearly cover the cost of the extra school buildings, the extra class sizes, the extra teachers that you would need to teach these kids that are being driven out of the private sector.
Let's turn it to Pauline's question. She said, another week and another crash on Redbourne Lane. Has there been any improvements on road safety since you started your campaign? So it doesn't feel like it. What's your answer to that, Bim?
The council has not been acting as fast as we'd like. I mean, I just lose track of the amount of times we've spoken to them. They have made some improvements, but not nearly as many as we'd like. And we just keep going. You know, it's very, very difficult to deal with it, partly because it's not really clear always what's required. The road's quite long. There are different things required at different bits. So, you know, we keep going. You know, sometimes campaigns are not won really, really quickly. We've just got to keep going.
Do you think that there has been an improvement in road safety, though? Because, you know, you've talked on Mix 92.6.
There have been some improvements, yes. They have made some improvements to the roads, but small ones.
And the other thing that I would say, you know, you've said quite a few times is if you see a road issue, people can message you directly, can't they?
Email. Yeah, they do.
There you go. So if you do see any problems in your area, message your local councillors or MP. James has moved it on to asking you, Bim, will you be backing the Save St Albans Fight the Freight campaign? We cannot allow our area to be ruined by this monstrosity. Now, obviously, this isn't in your constituency, but it could affect your constituents. What do you think on this issue, Bim?
I am, and the person who asked me that should look at Hansard from a while ago, because I've made this point on the floor of the House. We should never have allowed this to go ahead, because we're looking for areas of housing in this area quite desperately. We had a brownfield site. We should have used all of that for housing. Instead, they think that we should use it for the rail freight site, which is a mistake, and will significantly impact services to Harkenden, in my view. And I've seen this 4 years ago with the train timetable debacle. You know, you've got to be very, very careful around these critical commuter services. On top of being able to provide housing on that site, for me, housing all the way, it's a big mistake, and I said so at the time.
So will you be going to kind of back this campaign in terms of trying to overturn it? I mean, what can be done now to stop it?
I need to check where we are on the stages. I'm not entirely sure where we are on the stages, but, you know, doing what we can.
Okay. Connor's moved it on to asking, what's the progress on the banking hub as more places are shutting down this year?
Well, banks that we dealt with have all said they're committed to doing a banking hub. So the question is, how do we actually get it done? And that is something that, you know, I've been spending time talking to people like Derek French, who's a Harpenden constituent and a campaigner on this issue. The difficulty isn't so much getting a banking hub, it's finding a site that is in the centre of Harpenden where you can do one, and also agreeing what the services are there. Because the truth is that the number of people who use it is comparatively small, but what they use it for is also quite limited. And there's going to be a few arguments about how broad is the suite of services that are offered. So everybody agrees in principle we need one. All the banks, we've spoken to them all, they all say they'll do one. It's just a question of exactly where we do it, which I think is a difficulty now.
William has said, is anyone going to be punished for the money wasted on the Harpenden Public Halls homes debacle?
They should be. But, you know, guys, if Harpenden votes, you know, two-thirds Green, Lib Dem councillors, and the Lib Dems do it, I'm afraid this is why when you have elections, they have consequences. You know, there's nothing I can do about it. The Liberal Democrats in St Albans are making the decisions. You know, if you vote Conservative, then will actually fix this problem. But if you continue, if 2/3 of Parliament votes for Lib Dem councillors, well, this is what you get.
We're going to move on to Claire's question. She said, could the local area have a New Year's resolution of filling the potholes in the roads?
I'm with Claire on this. Driving me bananas.
And Maya has finished the last questions. Obviously, we were going to talk a little bit early in the month, so there's two New Year's resolutions questions on here. She's asked, Bim, do you have any New Year's resolutions?
No, I don't really do them. I think it's, that's not true, actually. This year I did. I sort of could see the inevitability as I'm about to turn 37. The inevitability of mid-age spread started to come upon me, and I'm taking real action to avoid it.
So what is this real action?
Eating better.
Oh, that is a tough
task. Eating better. You know what? A lot of it is discipline, right? So it's just about being a bit more disciplined. I'm doing okay so far. I'm quietly proud of myself, or seeing as I'm doing it on the radio, less than quietly proud of myself.
And in terms of it, are you coupling this up with gym? You know, we've talked a few times. I mean, we've talked about it today in terms of the parking at local gyms. But are you heading there pumping some iron?
Local gyms. I mean, I just can't bear gyms. I admire people who do. I can't. So I sort of find, you know, go for runs, cycle, walks. Chop wood for the fire in my house, which is actually really tight. If you're not into chopping wood, go and chop some. Very, very good activity.
And I think one final thing was from reading your, you know, Twitter and everything, you said that you're committing to reading more fiction this year.
Yeah, I haven't achieved that so far. But actually, there's a book on Crassus. He was really in Rome. He was sort of part of the triumvirate with Pompey the Great and Caesar. And there's a new book on Crassus, which I think is a novel, but it's a historical novel. I might read that.
It has been useful to speak to you today, Bim, and you will be back again very, very soon so people can continue sending in your messages. But
no
as
problem.
Always, thank you for coming on to the show with me today.
No problem at all. Thank you.